You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Christ is risen. And I say that because today is the 19th of April, 2023, and we are in what's called Bright Week, or the celebratory week after Pascha or Easter. I hope everyone's Lent went well. Everyone's Pascha went well. Today we're going to talk about something that's not entirely unrelated. And it's something that I've only dealt with before indirectly. And I reread Michael Houghton's book on the topic. And of course, we're talking about usury. Usury, not just as a economic phenomenon, but as a philosophical, specifically ontological, phenomenon as well. It shouldn't surprise anybody. And this is Michael Hoffman's view, with, you know, the sin that used to be but isn't anymore, or words to that effect. It used to be spoken of pretty regularly. The subject of many books, both in the ancient or the patristic world, as well as the medieval world. And terms like usury, or, you know, excessive interest, have been, as I've said 100 times, been bastardized. But usury really is the extraction of cash, income, that does not derive from production. It's very similar to the word rent. In other words, it's money taken via a position of political or economic power. So extortion is an example of usury. But so is the ability to drive down wages through moving capital overseas, or threatening to move capital overseas, or importing third world people into a first world country. All of these are examples of rents, unearned income. Right now I'm working on a paper on the political economy of oligarchy. Since the market doesn't apply anymore, because we're dealing with an oligarchy, we're dealing with a globalized oligarchy, economic analysis has to change. It has to take this into consideration. Markets are created. They're invented, not responded to, as the free market ideology will say. And with the collapse of entrepreneurship and now the instability of the currency, small, medium-sized businesses are dwarfed by the great centralized conglomerates. Things like expropriation, rent, and usury, these are absolutely dominant terms when you're dealing with the political economy of oligarchy, and this is why usury is so important. The Enlightenment saw the development of the ideology of the drive for wealth and power. Of course, through most of our history, the point of life was far higher than that, but in the Newtonian universe, I suppose it makes sense, and certainly in the Darwinian one. But our social disintegration began with the Reformation, because this attitude, this nominalist attitude, was one of the essential ingredients to the foundation of the Enlightenment. Luther and Calvin, I want to say specifically Calvin, altered the alteration of the concept of usury, and they did this in line with the Italian city-state. So the Reformation is a huge part of the problem, but only a part of the problem. So what was a deadly sin just, you know, not that long ago, became, at least in some circumstances, something that we can and we should praise. But of course, that's not the case at all. And we know that there are lengthy, there'd be scriptural, canonical condemnations of usury, because it's an ongoing problem. The charging of rents, that kind of extraction is an ongoing problem. It shows a collapse of the society. But it's condemned in such vehement terms over so many centuries because usury adds profit, brings profit for those who don't work, that is to say, don't produce. I don't have to tell you that money is a mere medium of exchange, but it is, to this day, especially to this day, viewed with what might be called a superstitious terror. And usury gives the impression that money can reproduce as if it were organic. Usury, then, is, as I've said before, the most crass form of materialism. One of the more obnoxious manifestations of our lives today is the refusal to see dominant ideas as simply a matter of self-interest. Denying the obvious based on self-interest or special pleading is particularly irritating. But it isn't so much that usury is no longer a sin. It's rarely spoken of except in our circles. But like so much, it's been redefined. And I've quoted, I've published on this a few times, and I like to use J. Richards, who tried to defend this idea in Crisis Magazine. Crisis is a Catholic neocon magazine I actually subscribed to in college in the early 90s. And his argument is that capital investment is not usury or doesn't count as usury when the money is lent at interest. That is for the sake of capital investment. Now, he doesn't speak of the Old Testament's lengthy condemnations of precisely this. And he also neglects to mention in this and other articles on the topic that interest is compounded. And compound interest makes up today a huge portion of the price of any commodity. Now, Richard's paper, which I've published on in a few different places, and I want to quote him again, and this is his interpretation of the parable of the talents in the New Testament. He says, the master expected the servant to invest, to put the money at risk. At the very least, the master tells the servant he should have put it in a bank where it could bear interest. Jesus isn't giving an economics lesson. The parable is about the kingdom of God, but he treats prudent risk, investment, and interest in a positive light. Now, to remind you, the parable of the talents concerns the people who were entrusted with a sum of money to invested it and received the profit. One buried it and only gave the principal back. And Richard is trying to say, and this comes up a few times, that this shows that there's no, and so, you know, he imposes modern and postmodern economics onto a parable uttered in the ancient world. Now, what was Christ actually talking about? Richard doesn't seem to realize that the redefinition of usury means that he can't really interpret any mention of interest or usury in the ancient world. But the banks of the era between, say, Socrates and the rise of the Byzantine Empire, let's say under Theodosius the Great, banks were pagan temples. And money was worshipped as a talisman. And in much of the pagan world, ritual prostitution and abortion, including the sacrifice of children at Tyre, the capital of world usury, and the Tyre and Phoenicia founded Carthage, that usury in the ancient world was tightly connected to the attack on reproduction, whether it be economic, artificial production or human reproduction. The prophets, the three, they're so-called minor prophets, which is, that just means that they're shorter works. Joel, Hosea, and especially Amos could not be stricter in this regard. And they condemn and strongly implicate the banks as, in fact, temples. And that's what this Mr. Richards is trying to claim Christ was supporting. Interest doesn't fall from the sky. And using the passive voice to talk about interest being earned covers over the fact that, I don't care if it's an ancient or a modern bank, they don't add value to anything. The concept of interest on a loan, for example, can only be considered an expropriation of labor, which is expropriated from earners, taken from earners, those who actually produce and produce value, and given to those who don't. Now, Christ isn't giving an economics lesson, and he wouldn't do this because it was done over and over again by these very same prophets. Let me quote Richards again. He says, put simply, usury is charging someone for something that has no value, in short, for defrauding someone, especially the poor and dependent in a financial transaction. And this is a quote that this is how usury has been and continues to be redefined. And I've written elsewhere that this particular line doesn't have a footnote. And it's probably a good idea because that was never the definition of usury in the ancient, medieval, or the early modern world. From Babylon to the Rothschilds, that was never the definition of usury. To defraud someone is evil by definition. So basing interest on it would be just a redundancy. He's doing the fallacy of special pleading. Interest isn't earned by the institution that lends. Rather, it's earned by those who are paid the utter minimum. Those who actually create value, so interest can be paid on those who do not produce value. So, trying to associate usury and fraud is dishonest. Of course, it's an aspect of fraud, but that doesn't come close to exhausting the concept. The article I'm talking about came out in 2014, and it's, Did the Church Change Its Doctrine on Usury? Of course, he's speaking with the Catholic Church. But he starts off by misdefining the concept. And so at that point, everything is simply arbitrary. His argument can't make sense if he just redefines the term. Now, interest is fraudulent exactly because it's expropriation. The interest that anyone takes is earned by those who work for a living. And as Hoffman says, and so many others who have dealt with this topic over the years, it went from being a very important dominant area of social theology to not being mentioned at all. And as I just showed, the common idea seems to connect usury to fraud in order to protect the taking of interest. And that is just that's simply historically illiterate. But people who will crusade for a crusade against ecumenism and doctrinal purity and just, spend their entire lives doing this rarely, if ever, talk about usury as a form of rent or usury at all. But of course it is in canon law. You know, capitalism, usury, and hence enforced poverty have been put to the background. Things like sexual sins and many others have taken its place. Now, the political cash value here is how the regime, how global capitalism functions. And of course, interest, usury, and debt are all very closely related. And debt is used by the regime's banks, in two specific ways, two mechanisms. These are the destruction of national independence, a form of recolonization, including places that have never been colonies, and it renders them into raw materials producers, raw material producers for the system, the equivalent of low-wage labor in the West. International loans usually carry a 15% at a minimum rate. And so in order to pay this back, that has to be the economic growth, which, of course, can't be maintained for long, if at all. So the ultimate point is that usury, in this regard, the victim society, the country that's borrowing, will eventually fall into the hands of its creditors. And those creditors are not state bodies. The country then is sold off until no economy really remains, at least in native hands, and Ukraine is one of the most obnoxious examples of this. The concept of speculation, in an economic sense, not in the philosophical sense, betting on the price of commodities, when it gets that kind of attention, the commodity, whatever you're betting on, is driven upwards in price, at least for a short time. Making matters worse, the financial press is talking about the economic boom attracting yet more investment into whatever we're talking about. But the boom itself often has nothing to do with production. It's a bubble, and a bubble is debt based on nothing. And it pops and self-destructs. So once the boom profits have dried up, these overvalued assets finally are brought down to what they really are, those assets then can be bought up for pennies on the dollar. So then you have another illusory boom, which only increases the presence of foreign capital. But little is actually produced. I've spoken about derivatives on the Daily Nationalist, and the derivatives are based on nothing. It's a classic postmodern economy that there is no referent to this money. I mean, at the very least, many years ago, interest could be taken on productive investment, not the money that goes into productive investment, but the investment itself. Let me summarize so far. Usury as a term and an economic concept is defined in the 19th and 20th century as an excessive rate of interest. Now, that can't be the definition because it contains a value judgment. Definitions of things can't have a value judgment attached to it because objects aren't a value judgment. They're the foundation of such judgments. And as I've said, usury is the ability to extract rents. It's the result of a relationship of economic power, economic and political power, political economy, where those with money are able to use that status and whatever political power they can capture to extract rents, expropriation of actual production for and from a non-economic sector. So rents aren't based on a market, they're not based on labor, and they're not based on any value in use. in some of my writings on this topic that are still floating around. Of course, I spend a lot of time in the Old Testament, which I think is essential to understanding the New and the church as a whole. Deuteronomy, of course, the book of the law itself, says, chapter 23, "Thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother, usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury." In other words, this is not merely an economic interaction. Now, the word brother is used here, and so it makes sense. A brother suggests an ethical relationship, the opposite of egocentric demands. Proverbs says, "He that by usury and unjust gain increases his substance, he shall gather it for him that will pity the poor." And that's 28. Ezekiel says the same thing. He says, "In thee have they taken gifts to shed blood. Thou hast taken usury and increase, and thou hast greedily gained of thy neighbors by extortion, and hast forgotten me, says the Lord God." Ezekiel 22. The regime will tell you that this sort of thing is the work of a primitive mentality. It doesn't have any relevance in the modern, or in reality, postmodern economy. Well, so much the worse for the postmodern economy. Modern people love to believe that they don't have the superstitions of the mentally weak men of the ancient world. And yet, it is held in superstitious awe, as I've mentioned already, because at least millions of people see wealth, cash and otherwise, as an essential mark of distinction and celebrity. In fact, in my paper, I'm not sure I'm going to be done with it, but The Political Economy of Oligarchy, the concept of the superstar, CEO or athlete, implicitly contains a justification of giant salaries. Giant salaries, whether in cash or stock or whatever, not to mention social influence, that is not reflected in performance. So usury, and this is really a bellwether of how this works, usury went from a sin, it's not excessive interest, it's essentially a rent. Today, where usury has become the basic, critical policy of all modern and postmodern economies, because finance capital, having full control over money and its value, filters and directs investment. But even that's a problem, because the interest is taken from the money, not production. Therefore, we're not even talking about productive investments here. It could be. It's still expropriation and rent taken directly from those who actually produce value. In the postmodern world, it's little more than the strip mining of assets and the quick liquidation of new acquisitions. And of course, the one of the most vile examples is the rape of the Slavic world after the fall of the USSR. Summarizing it further, from the Christian point of view, the concept of usury, to use a colloquial phrase, is taking advantage of someone else. Or as Cicero condemned in the Roman Republic so vehemently, prospering at another's expense. So this is a much older and broader definition of usury that doesn't rely on value judgments like too much interest. It's extracting wealth as rent. And in condemning this, really, in Cicero's work, is almost the foundational, even the sole maxim of natural law. And the wealthy are the only ones that are capable of amassing such massive stores of capital to lend, whether real or fictitious. Usury exists and can only exist because of a radical imbalance in control of wealth. And you know all the statistics of how much of the domestic product the top 1.5% control. And that goes for stock as well. So usury doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists in an ideological world, which is, you know, essentially post-Reformation. And in a social world where a tiny percentage of the population control a ridiculous amount of wealth. You're talking about almost $1 trillion as an increase when COVID, just through that COVID era, the lockdown era, added to the store of wealth of that, you know, 0.5%. And this is why Walmart was allowed to stay open. And yet the mom and pop store on the corner selling roughly the same kind of things was shut down. Let me quote Gregory of Nyssa, who, like all the church fathers, has a sermon against usury. Most of the church fathers have something like this in their collected works. Here's what he says. Money lending has no value and is rapacious. It is unfamiliar with such trades as agriculture. Like a beast, usury dwells in one place and delights in banquets. Moneylending wants everything to be wild and begets whatever has been untilled. Usury's home is a threshing floor upon which the fortunes of the oppressed are winnowed and where it considers everything as its own. Moneylending despises people contented with their possessions and treats them as enemies because they do not provide money. It watches courts of law to find persons in distress who demand payment and follows tax collectors who are a nest of vultures in battle array prepared for war. He doesn't mention interest here at all. Moneylending is the term, and it's the very act of moneylending, not so-called excessive interest, that matters. It's unfamiliar with such trade. He actually says such trades as agriculture and commerce, meaning that mere exchange isn't the problem. And when he says delights and banquets, he's talking about the decadence and wasteful spending. I have a paper on the challenging the idea that capitalism is the most efficient way to invest. But what I just read is the basic argument against usury. The very fact, and the problem is this disproportionate power, that somehow because an institution has a lot of power, therefore what they do is correct. Major banks and those connected to them are conglomerates. They enjoy a tremendous amount of prestige. They endow entire universities. They sponsor the state rather than the other way around. And systematically draw wealth from those who produce value to those who do not. Let me give you, and I've done this in many years ago, but let me repeat here the elements of the critique of usury. Number one, it is a manifestation of capitalism, but not the free market. Banks grow so powerful, making both private and public sectors dependent on them. So the taxpayer ends up paying for the recklessness of that rentier class. Part of the political economy of oligarchy is that the way to success is the ability to privatize profit and socialize losses. Oligarchy is the opponent of private property. It has nothing to do with market economics. It's neither rational nor efficient. Earlier theorizing about market exchange rarely had anything to do with actual finance capital. It had something to do with productive investment built and financed largely by the same people. Number two, the claim that banks are somehow rational. We know that, you know, today we know that's not true. And they're rational only in that they seek those investments that will turn a profit. I use an example. I say, well, Berkshire Hathaway in Omaha is a conglomerate because it takes into itself very powerful and successful firms, including Microsoft, Omaha Steaks, Coca-Cola. So banks end up competing with one another to throw money and to lend money at this elite group, given you're pretty much going to have a certain return. It means that these kind of firms, due to their extraordinary power, the ability to extract rents, not only get low rates, but they also get the lion's share of credit. Real entrepreneurs, of course, which is a dying art, they're not backed by elite forces. And so one of their many struggles is credit. Oligarchy extracts usury, not just in that interest is taken from each and every investment ever made anywhere, but also in the idea that investment is accomplished only for the short-term gain of those same elites. Number three, when usury is institutionalized, it gradually leads to the total control over a society, meaning that in part, production is actively suppressed, is considered lesser in prestige and power, and wealth ends up being diverted. It goes from production to rents, things like derivatives. Now, St. Gregory of Nyssa is writing in the late antique period, the patristic era. There, the concept of entrepreneurship was quite well known. Even then, you know, talent and innovation and hard work remained, at the time, under the thumb of those who controlled access to money. Now, you'll hear the occasional apologist for the modern system of banking. They'll claim that interest is being extracted on productive investment rather than on money. And this is simply not true, albeit very common. The interest is taken on money, not investment. Because regardless of whether or not anything is produced with this money, or if any profit is made, the lender still requires its interest and will liquidate part of this discounted capital in order to get it, often using the state. Many years ago, I did something on Islamic banking where they try to avoid usury. And the concept is it's only in production that the lender actually gains anything. So if the enterprise fails, all parties lose. In the West, if the enterprise fails, the bank still will extract its money. And we know from the bailouts, starting from, it goes back to Chrysler in the 70s, 2008, and today, to the point now the state permits banks to simply expropriate entire accounts. The so-called bail-in idea, which is always described in very technical terms, which they try to avoid bailouts by simply saying you can take all of the deposits of your customers, of those who have accounts, savings and checking accounts in your bank. Somehow that's better. I suppose it just cuts out an intermediate step. I've never mentioned this before, but Chaucer's Canterbury Tales spends a lot of time on usury. In fact, making very similar arguments. Merchants, in the financial sense, are shown to be parasites in Shipman's Tale. But the purpose here is making a point about value in that commerce, in the bad sense of the term, in its relation to labor. If a worker sells a product of his skill, any profit that can be justified, if and only if it's congruent with that worker's own investment and his ability, that's really what you're paying for. But as economies get more complex, this is where the banker then makes an appearance. And their entire world, and this isn't necessarily a matter of the merchant class, although of course it normally is, This is specifically a financial matter. Those people do not produce. Rather, they manipulate those who do. Which means, socially speaking, both as a cause and a consequence, self-interested materialism and things like derivatives takes the place of vocation and skill and true labor. Chaucer actually says that money is a power, seemingly, in its own right. And this power is based on the rule of those who can enforce it. He creates an argument that will be used by John Calvin many centuries later, in that the merchant in the tale justifies his position by saying that the financier gives needed money to those people who are likely to pay it back. In other words, it's in the interest of the merchant to lend only to those who will productively use that money and thus create a profit. Chaucer, of course, completely rejects it. What he says instead is something else. The merchant functions by convincing an actual producer of value that he can increase market share and profits and everything else using tricks of a trade unknown to ethics and certainly natural law. Carefully cultivated skill is certainly something to invest in, but only in that it actually produces things. Chaucer implies that usury is based on the desperation of those who are willing to sign anything to get what they need. Hunger, want, social exclusion leads to short-term thinking. A bad time, depression, leads to short-term thinking, and it can be taken advantage of by anyone. Not intelligent, but in fact devious. No one's in favor of extracting interest from the poor. And in fact, this is part of the redefinition of the word usury, where it's only bad when it's a means of taking advantage of the desperate. But that's a tiny piece of the problem. No one's going to defend that. You don't need a whole doctrine about it. No one's in favor of that. But it tempts productive people to expand beyond their means, and then promises them wealth and renown and untold riches. Thomas Aquinas, the greatest of the scholastics, spends quite a bit of time on that. Now, Michael Hoffman says that Aquinas is someone who began the justification of certain forms of usury here. But Thomas says that money loaned at quote-unquote moderate interest, and for the sake of the commonweal, is praiseworthy. Not just neutral, but praiseworthy. Now, that does not count as usury, and can't be confused with it. This is Summa Section 2. The condemnation is the control over money for the sake of speculative investment. One sort of a loan, when it seeks to earn a profit through needed labor, that will benefit everybody. But that is not the same thing as money making money. And Hoffman says that in a certain way, Thomas Aquinas pulled out, to put it, the first brick in the dam. And it took very little to exploit, so to speak, the hole he just opened in the doctrine. But regardless, modernity and certainly postmodernity dispense with all of this. I mean, it's almost inconceivable, especially to the mass. Can't even conceive a world where banks don't control commerce, production, and investment. And the fact that governments, these massive structures with massive standing armies, inconceivable to the ancient medieval worlds or even the early modern world, constantly need cash. And this is how banks oversee both public and private sector investments. Let me quote Martin Luther here. Money engaged in business and money put out at Zins are two different things. And the one cannot be compared with the other. The latter has a base which is constantly growing and producing profit out of the earth without any fear of capital losses. While there is nothing certain about the former, and the only interest it yields is accidental and cannot be counted on. Now I use the word Zins. That is as close to as the German language gets to rent in the sense of rent seeking. Now, no one can pretend that the great patristic writers somehow were unaware of the difference between productive financing and usury. But whether it be Thomas, whether it be Luther, even in the most extreme case of Calvin, make the same argument that the risk a financier takes when financing something is sufficient reason to charge interest. Now, Luther had the more traditional idea before the Radical Reformation took over. Luther didn't accept the idea that banks should take their pound of flesh out of anything they can, but only actual profitable, hence productive investment. But neither Thomas nor Luther justifies or even considers, nor could they, the present rule of financial capital. And because of all of these bailouts, they have, as he would say, no fear of capital losses, Luther says. The problem with these three is that they created a justification for a systematic regime based on rent-seeking oligarchy. And it doesn't take much for someone profiting from this system to rationalize all their profits this way. How quickly meanings become elastic and imprecise, they become a spectrum, which is the opposite of a definition. And you reach a point where usury, so long as it doesn't take from beggars in the streets, is all about the common good. Let me quote Calvin now. This is in his commentary on Psalm 15. There is no worse species of usury than an unjust way of making bargains, where equity is disregarded on both sides. Let us then remember that all bargains in which one party unrighteously strives to make gain by the loss of the other party, whatever name may be given to them, are here condemned. Those who are paying attention may notice that he actually didn't say anything there. So when there is equity in the contract, that is, there's no desire to take advantage of another, the interest charge is acceptable. So if the desire of the usurer is something other than the desire to take advantage of somebody's want and need and injure them in the process, the interest is acceptable. And the implication is that the great patristic writers, let alone the Old Testament, were lumping equitable loans from those somehow designed to inflict pain. In his very argument here, Calvin uses the word unjust to make the claim that certain kinds of interest are unjust, where equity is disregarded. Well, I don't need Calvin to tell me this. No one advocates for equity and being disregarded. He uses words unjust and unrighteously. So it's a circular argument. To make gain by the loss of another. That's what is condemned. As if that's what they were talking about in the ancient world of the Old Testament. And I wrote, I think it was about 2014 or earlier, I said, Calvin goes far out of his way to colossally miss the point. Calvin also glosses over the fact that money does not spring out of the earth. It must be created, and created through labor. This labor is then appropriated by those who've done nothing to create it is a problem that, at least for him, he doesn't raise. It's probably redundant to say that the Medici clan in Florence used similar arguments. And even the papacy a state like any other required access to credit to maintain its presence in the world, politically speaking. The early Medicis claimed that the only time a loan was usurious is when the profit was certain, which is a twisting of the ancient attack on usury. If profit was uncertain, that is, risky, then the interest charge was not usurious, which is, to say the least, a self-serving definition, and it permitted the Medicis to rule over the papacy, as well as North Italy in the guise of the so-called Republic. So, by separating the concept of usury from its foundation, that is to say, rent-seeking, it means that the real meaning of the word was destroyed. And as any world history text will probably explain, the Medicis had very creative ways of getting around usury laws of the day. And it's significant because it's a way that the prohibition against this practice affected the nature of the business or of business in the Renaissance. So they developed the concept, in other words, of the promissory note. The Medicis ended up claiming that international exchanges, that is to say, one currency among others, did not constitute a loan, let alone one that you could talk about usury on. Now, interest, of course, was hidden in the nature of this so-called exchange, and most theologians in Rome at the time thought this quite acceptable. But the very fact that the Medicis were able to elect several popes, it just goes to show how powerful usury can be. But you have writers, the Becker book in 1962 argues that the Medici didn't have to lie like this. The Medici cartel simply hired Florentine clergy that sold dispensations for the practice. Again, several popes were from this family, and that, you know, accelerated the ecclesiastical acceptance of the practice. The concept of civic debt was also used to avoid usury prohibitions. So, for example, Florence found itself in debt. It was then able to argue that it required outside funding. This implies that any financier from the outside wants some return, and they claim that this return is not usury because A, it is not practiced by the city directly, and B, it is not about profit, but about attracting cash for the sake of civic peace. This was also a successful argument, and one of the things that brought the Middle Ages to a close. In Russian history, usury, I think, will forever be associated with Khazaria. The empire charged tolls on passing merchants, and that became the dominant, if not primary, form of income. The top layer of society was Jewish and extracted tribute from their conquered peoples. But they even had a small but very powerful group of bankers in Kiev as early as the 10th century. And as we all know, Prince Svatoslav destroyed this empire, in the Middle Volga, even the North Caucasus. And the result of that ended up being Jewish support for the Mongol attackers or Turkic nomads. And maybe as many as 5 million Russians were taken into slavery from these raids, according to several sources from the 15th to the 18th century. When you look at the galley ships, the Venetian war rowers were often Slavs. But even in later years, the threat didn't abate. Even state-supported loans did not compete with Jewish houses at the local level. They'd even sell at a loss for the sake of undercutting competition. Well, the heavy impact on usury on old Russia is not that difficult to discover. The Jewish Kahal, years later, long after the fall of Khazaria, right up until the, 19th century, their average rate because credit was hard to find, was about 120%. And at the local level, Jewish usury was linked to their near monopoly on vodka sales, which meant that after serfdom was legislated away, a new market was open for them that incorporated both. And this is why in 1892, 1893, anti-Jewish riots broke out over the manipulation of peasants with vodka to mortgage these newfound lands. I had a whole show on Derzhavin's Jewish committee. And this is one of the things, of course, that they discovered. As I've written elsewhere, the criminal code of the Russian Empire, which the edition is 1903, continued to see usury as a crime. But this is how they defined it. And I'm paraphrasing here. If a borrower is forced under extreme circumstances to take an unfavorable loan, that's the foundation for the crime. Then the concealment of compound interest, or the very idea of compound interest, was a large part of the criminal aspect of this. It's just another variation of fraud. And then adding penalties to the interest rate itself made the crime aggravated. And the last element is using that money to buy grain from peasants that are in trouble at very low prices was what it was legally speaking, the last element in this crime. This is a crass version of a rent. The law stated, I think just as a matter of practicality, not necessarily doctrine, anything over 12% was considered usurious. And the very idea of compound interest. And let me quote St. John of Kronstadt. And this was his last diary. Try to mentally compare cities, especially the capital city of St. Petersburg, and our rural countryside, and wonder at the contrast between the two. In the cities, luxury to the point of insanity, millions spent on unnecessary splendor. In our villages, poverty, simplicity, rye bread, water, or tea. They may possess a few sheep, maybe a horse, basic food, and basic clothing. If you take into account the incessant fires that burn all to the ground in the village, then there's no surprise as to the widespread misery. Urbanites are surrounded by wealth. The village is immersed in poverty. Villagers are the martyrs. They are always a sad people. Of these last, many are the first in the new age to come. By 1900, Jews made up about 40% of the Russian merchant class, being much less than 1% of the population. So by the time World War I breaks out, there were 187 credit unions, 26 banks, 15 banking houses, 33 banking offices, and 37 mutual credit societies. Of that group, of that 187, only two didn't have Jews in high management. I think many of you are also aware that Karl Marx blamed the Jews for materialism. He wrote on the Judenfrage, he says, while not making usury a dominant part of his economic critique, though, he did condemn that this, you know, basically. And let me, this is from 1861, 1863, his addenda. Marx says, on the other hand, interest-bearing capital is the perfect fetish. It is capital in its finished form, in the form of interest-bearing capital. Only this function remains without the mediation of either production process or circulation. Interest-bearing capital is a consummate automatic fetish, the self-expanding value, money making money. And in this form, it no longer bears any trace of its origin. The social relation is consummated as a relation of things, or money, commodities, the relation of things to themselves. Marx, along with people like Proudhon, Chesterton, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, many others in the modern era, rejected these modern justifications of usury. Karl Marx is rarely quoted. when he's criticizing the Jews, but only in his early writings, his very early writings. His early writings are actually worth reading. Usury itself is not a major topic in economics. Now, Marx uses a term fetish, and it's something like a superstition. The belief that money is actually an organic thing that can reproduce itself, like cats can. It's no accident that the Medicis financed the revival of pagan alchemy. If all metals are reducible to the same substance, then all things are one. That means organic and inorganic things are the same. Now, of course, metals refer to people, and alchemy usually refer to the making or remaking and recreating of a population. Let me summarize this way. Modern arguments in favor of usury seem to want to make the distinction between profitable investment and, as I mentioned in the John Calvin thing, the sadistic model of the usurer psychotic. It's a caricature, something that Calvin used, as I mentioned, to justify this growing and consolidating ruling class. It's a ridiculous idea. That is not what they meant by usury. That's inherently evil. It doesn't need an explanation. So the mentality that went into the entire practice of usury when it became institutionalized was revolutionary and required a total revision in ontology. Zizek's book from 2012, he argues that St. Augustine's condemnation of usury and its associated practices comes from this broader theology. St. Augustine, who, by the way, a profound influence on Luther, saw usury as a product, as we've been talking about, a product of a deeper and more pervasive evil. And that evil is competing economic interests, which are the root of fallen and fragmented man. And in my book on nominalism, I have nominalism as the foundation of all of this. Ultimately, a society based on economic and financial classes, not estates, but classes based on money and ownership, will lead eventually to the enslavement of one section of the population, the overwhelming majority. This ruling class gets smaller and smaller over time. Really, today, only in two massive investment firms, Vanguard and, of course, the much larger BlackRock. As this gets smaller and smaller, and the ethnicity of it is more and more blatant, they do need to hide the idea that the rule is based solely on non-productive economic manipulation. Despite what other writers have said, the Medici couldn't really proclaim their rule and the nature of their rule. Goldman Sachs can't advocate pure banking oligarchy in those terms. And it's one of the reasons that they use very technical language, quantitative easing, and terms like that. But the result of this is that politics, that language, that ethics, culture becomes detached from the reality of life. Words become talismans for a way to divert attention from evil, and of course creating a caricature in its place. It didn't take long for the concept of usury to change its definition. It became a very obvious ethical evil that only apparently referred to those who are poverty-stricken. It began, and it should be defined, as more or less a synonym for the rentier income, or the rentier class, those who live by rent. And quickly, it degenerated into the practice of stealing bread from starving children, as if we need doctrine to tell us that that's wrong. But neither Thomas nor Luther, neither one of them wanted to justify usury. But they wanted to make a distinction that is based on basic common sense. Their intention wasn't to justify usury. Calvin probably was. But even indirect arguments, that's what this, during the Reformation and after, what this new ruling class needed to hear. And it was music to their ears, just like Darwin was in the midst of the Industrial Revolution in Britain. Usury became something different than what, for example, someone like Cicero or Gregory of Nyssa thought. In other words, interest is okay so long as it's not taken from the lower classes. People like Karl Marx talked about money as a recreation. Let me quote him again in the 1844 manuscripts, or his so-called early writings. He's talking about money, and he says, "It is the visible divinity, the transformation of all human and natural properties into their contraries, the universal confounding and distortion of things, impossibilities are soldered together by it. It's a common whore, the common procurer of people and nations, the distorting and confounding of all human and natural qualities, the fraternization of impossibilities. The divine power of money lies in its character as man's estranged, alienating, and self-disposing nature. Money is the alienated ability of mankind." There's a lot worthwhile in Marx's early writings, and this is one of them. We talk about the alienated ability. That is another way of saying the justification of expropriating value from those who actually have skill. It becomes alienated in that it's not the possession of those with the skill. Rather, it becomes the possession of the financier. Usury and capitalism, of course, are distinct but very closely related. And theologically speaking, they are heresies. And they're heresies because they are an implicit denial of God's creation. What Karl Marx is saying here is very powerful. Money is what gives value to things. Human virtues and talents don't exist anymore. Everything is projected onto the currency fetish. Money, not God, is a result of man's projecting his own pathetic weakness onto something. But Karl Marx's argument here, his attack on money, is identical to the concept of the Medici alchemical experiment. The distorting and confounding of all human and natural qualities, money takes its place. The universal confounding and distorting of things, money is what gives value to things, not the things in and of themselves. Money thus turns each of these powers, Marx says, into something which in itself it is not, turns it to its contrary. Like the philosopher's stone among the alchemists, money is the philosopher's stone of the modern and postmodern economies, meaning that it is a fundamental reality, ontologically or anything else. Someone could be turned from an ignoramus to a highly cultured individual solely from having money. Somehow that has an ontological component. Marx was also right to talk about the Jews because they don't have the ties to physical reality. And he wouldn't say this, but you know, they have no ties to logos either. And therefore can adopt an ideology where money has ontological properties. Very few people talk about that. I mean, Proudhon did as well. Bakunin, the anarchist, you know, that was a very long time ago, however. So this is the nature of usury and how you might answer some of the modern justifications of it, including from Christian circles. It's a deadly sin. The Old Testament and the New Testament and the patristic writers all say, with no exceptions. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.